everyone. Welcome again to Quantum Cosmos Festival. My name is Jen Dodd. I have the pleasure of being the Festival Programming Manager here at Parameter Institute. Welcome, everybody, and really glad you could join us both here in Waterloo and around the world. This lecture series is presented by KPMG, and this lecture in particular is sponsored by OpenText. We would like to extend our warm thanks to both KPMG and OpenText for supporting these events. Now, again, before we begin the lecture, please do turn off your BlackBerries and phones and anything else that may beep at us. And those of you at home might like to share this with your friends or colleagues. You can also follow us on Twitter if you're interested in doing that. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Stuart Brand. Stuart is the author of several books. My personal favorite is called How Buildings Learn. Reading his writings and learning about the institutions he's created has really caused me to change the way I work and think, and I think I'm in excellent company in this. I know he's had a deep influence on the environmental movement, on the development of online communities, and in many, many other areas. His latest work is a book entitled Whole Earth Discipline, which is the subject of today's talk. So please join me in welcoming Stuart Brand.
Thanks, Jen. How's the sound? We're good, I think. I guess this talk belongs in a science series because I'm trying to urge my fellow environmentalists to take science seriously, to follow science seriously, all the time, rather than just when it's convenient for ideological reasons. Let me go back a little ways. Back in 1948, when I was 10 years old, I took my pledge as an American to save and faithfully to defend from waste the natural resources of my country, its air, soil, and minerals, its forests, waters, and wildlife. That was a conservation pledge, and obviously warped my mind, because then I went on to Stanford and got a degree in ecology and evolution, and then did the Whole Earth Catalog that pervaded a lot of appropriate technology. I was Mr. Natural for a while, and then wound up in a three-piece suit working for Jerry Brown, who was governor of California. And as a result of his administration, Californians now put out half the greenhouse gases of Americans in any other state, just because of rules that were put in place by that government. Now, this book introduces a couple of ideas. One is the idea of natural infrastructure, which I prefer to the idea of natural capital as a way to think about ecosystem services. I try to supplement the idea of the precautionary principle with the idea of the vigilance principle. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance, more liberty. Precautionary principle by itself tends to step in the way of liberty. And as I said, I'm trying to move environmentalists from being primarily romantic in their identification with natural systems, moving on very strongly to science, and then on through that toward engineering. And the very best preservationists and restorationists that I've worked with basically think of that process as a very large-scale gardening. But what I'm finding in the world is that the interviews, the newspapers, and so on, are more interested in a couple of kind of news items that emerge from this frame of reference in the book. And then I'm saying cities are green, and nuclear power is green, and genetic engineering is green, and geoengineering is probably going to have to happen. Those are the big news items. And they're more fun to illustrate, so let's work with those. Starting just passingly with climate, because everybody's seen the hockey stick diagrams and so on, but what I focus on is the many... Climate is a severely nonlinear system, only partially understood so far. The models are nowhere near as good as they need to be. We know the system is full of positive feedbacks, hidden thresholds, irrevocable tipping points. These are just a few of them that have been named. But what we also know, or are learning, is that it isn't climate that kills you. It's people fighting over the resources that are reduced by climate change. And the classic case so far, which we haven't understood in climate terms but should, is Darfur. Darfur is a place where the pastoral nomadic people with their herds and the agricultural people with their farms used to get along because there was enough water. When there stopped being enough water, then they started killing each other. A book I recommend to think about this kind of thing is called Constant Battles by Stephen LeBlanc, archaeologist at Harvard, who says that basically humans have always fought in an organized way, usually losing about 25% of all the young males to warfare all the time. That's gone down in the last few hundred years thanks to complex civilizations and societies. But if carrying capacity comes down from climate change, we'll go back to the old way. One place to worry about and think about in this regard is the Himalayan Plateau. Now, here's Bhutan. If you look at it in context, the Himalayan Plateau, those glaciers, those snows feed rivers that provide water for 40% of humanity. And some, like the Indus, goes through one nuclear-armed state, India, into another nuclear-armed state, Pakistan. And if they get fighting over that water as the glaciers melt, that will not be good. The Mekong is another, I think that goes through three nations who don't like each other very much. A couple of good books on climate, there's obviously lots of them, but one that's out here in the lobby I recommend, Jim Lovelock's The Vanishing Face of Gaia. Another good one just to get a sense of how quickly things get bad is called 6 Degrees. Okay, pivot from thinking about climate change as a whole Earth issue, to basically demographics, what's changing in the world as a whole Earth issue. There's 6.8 billion of us, and 5 out of 6 of us live in the developing world. That's where the power is shifting. These are folks who are moving into town, creating jobs, educating their kids. They are building infrastructure, and they are learning about protecting the natural infrastructure that is already there, forests, aquifers, biodiversity, and a predictable climate. Developing world is most of the world in terms of space, most of Africa, most of Latin America, most of Asia. The people in all those countries are on the move, and what they're doing is moving toward opportunity, wherever that might be. And what they've found is that it is in the cities. Cities create wealth, generate wealth, they always have, and they are now taking over as the major driver of what society, what humans do in the world. We are becoming a city planet. Canada is 80% urban, so are most developed countries, so will the whole world be by mid-century. The sequence has been that developed world passed 50% urban back in 1950, but everybody else is catching up way more rapidly than you might think. Now, historians have noticed that history is usually driven by the largest cities in the world, and this is who they are now. They're almost all in developing countries. Only one, New York, is in what we would call the West. And remember, these newly large cities are growing 3 times faster than the developed world cities did, and 9 times bigger. They are a different creature. And if something looks familiar about this list, look at who were the largest cities 1,000 years ago. Only 2 of them, you might say, were in the so-called West, and the rest were scattered all over the world. In other words, the 1,000 years of history we've just enjoyed, referred to as the rise of the West, rise of the West is over. Now we're seeing the rise of the rest, and that is very interesting. The statistics are incredible. Basically, 1.3 million people new in town every week. A lot of them are born there, but most of them are arriving there from the countryside. So what's the big attraction? The attraction is action. It's where things are going on. It's where opportunity is. This is a bustling squatter city known as Kibera, outside of Nairobi. About 1 million people live there. These are people not squashed by poverty, but busy getting out of poverty just as fast as they can. They are grassroots entrepreneurs. If they can't find a job, they create a job. They do the same with their housing, with the same with the whole town. There's a good book on this called Shadow Cities by Rob Neuwirth, who went and lived in four of these squatter cities, including Kibera. And his subtitle says, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. It's a billion in the squatter cities and slums now. Another billion is expected in the next decade or so. All these places are pretty busy. Here's a lane in a Delhi slum, a lane in one of Mumbai's many slums, shopping market in Rasinya, in one of Rio's favelas. Basically, this is urban life at its richest. It's tough, but it's dense. This is social capital at its richest. So everybody in a slum neighborhood knows each other, whether they want to or not. And the economic event is a hidden one called the informal economy. Everything's not licensed, you don't have deeds for the property, but everybody knows who can charge rent for a room in a building. Rough guesses by the United Nations is that in the developing countries, 60% of employment is in the informal economy. In other words, it's like dark energy in astrophysics. We didn't expect it. It's huge. We don't know how it fits in, but it changes everything. We do not have a theory of the informal economy yet. People who thought that slums drag cities down have to deal with facts like Mumbai, where basically the slums evidently help create prosperity, because Mumbai, which is half slums, is also 1/6 of the whole gross domestic product of India. My interest in infrastructure in the squatter cities, they basically make their own. Steal the electricity that's going by, run cords up to the houses, and that's electricity. They'll do anything to get it. Cities have this peculiarity of things being jammed right up next to each other. So here's a slum interface in Sao Paulo. If you look at the edge, you see what's really going on. Cities have this quality of, they call it economics of aggregation, but this is at its best. You're basically jamming supply and demand right next to each other. And so this looks like a gross inequity, in a way it is, but it's also convenient for people on both sides of that wall. So you've got the maids and cooks, gardeners and guards that work over in the boring rich neighborhood on the right, get to walk to work from the interesting part of town that they live in on the left. That kind of jamming together of unexpected things is really what cities are all about. It's like a coral reef. It's an intensity of activity and an intensity of resourcefulness. So here you have a foraging train and a near-reaching market brushing against each other. You know, one of the attractions of cities and why we go there is they're full of surprises. Looking around the enormous slum of Dharavi in Mumbai, you see no end of services of the slum dwellers for themselves and also for the formal economy in the richer parts of town. Among other things, they have 4,000 recycling units, 30,000 rag pickers. They're sorting 6,000 tons of rubbish every day. In other words, these are the greenest people on earth. They use minimal materials, minimal energy, minimal food. And they recycle everything. Here's one guy, Laxman Kumbi, he's in Dharavi. They're green because they're poor. And we may like them to remain green, but if that requires them to remain poor, they're not going to go along with it. They are climbing what's called the food ladder toward more protein. They are climbing what's called the electricity ladder toward full-time grid electricity. This gentleman told the photographer the electricity is on for 2 days, then off for 2 days, or not on at all. We don't have much space for the children to play in. They use the roads to play, and accidents take place again and again. I've not studied at all and am illiterate. For work, I stitch government jeans and pants. It's fine, but the workday ends late. I want to educate my kids, until the day I die. I'll educate them as long as I'm around. That's guaranteed. I'm not feeling sorry for this gentleman. I'm in awe of him, and I do not want to stand in his way as an environmentalist. I gave part of this talk at the State Department a couple of weeks ago, and I said, look, this is where we can help get these guys sanitation, electricity, water, and safety from being bulldozed. Because among the other things these folks are doing with the tiny amount of money they have is the families get together, hire a few teachers, and people who've studied them find that some of these pennies a day schools are better than the government provided schools for the poor kids. That's pretty interesting. So when you add this all up and look at it again in kind of whole earth terms, what you've got is new cities in the global south full of young people, old cities in the global north full of old people. Where do you think the action's going to be? Now, part of the study I did for this book kind of flipped my romanticism about villages. If all these people are leaving the villages, they can't have been that wonderful because nobody's forcing them to leave. But you do want villages to keep going for various reasons. And here's how you save a village. You connect it to town better with good roads, with good cell phone connections, which are absolutely swarming through the developing world. There are now many more there than there are in the developed world and way more resourcefully and innovatively used. And also, grid electricity is of great consequence out in the countryside. Because a village without grid electricity is basically a trap, a dark trap. One of the reasons people are leaving the villages is they're leaving subsistence agriculture, where you work like hell, you're not part of the cash economy at all. The weather changes or something bad happens, somebody gets hurt, bandits come through, and you have no recourse. That's what people move to town for, is some kind of recourse. When they move to town, these subsistence farms, which were on usually marginal land, very quickly grow back, especially in the tropics. And so the woods come back, the wild animals come back, they're not being eaten as bushmeat anymore. An astonishing fact I came across is that we're still cutting down primary rainforest, and we should not be. But because of people moving to town, 55 times more rainforest is coming back as second growth, where the people have left, than we are cutting down. There's a mysterious carbon sink that people wondered about going on, where the carbon is coming out of the atmosphere, and that may be one of the places. So the whole question of electrical power, which is the core of living in cities, the core of this transition I've been talking about, is that the cheapest source of electricity is coal, and everyone will keep burning it basically until alternatives are made cheaper or until governments simply require that coal is expensive. Baseload electricity is the always-on 24/7 electricity that cities especially require. So far, wind and solar can help, but they can't provide baseload because we don't have a way to store that very well yet. So that leaves you with basically hydroelectric power, which you guys have a lot of, and nuclear. So far, I thought there might be a fourth alternative with solar in space, but Elon Musk, who's running businesses, both SpaceX sending up real rockets and Solar City doing serious solar stuff, says that it's not worth it because even if you could get serious solar collectors to orbit for free, the cost and hassle of trying to microwave or otherwise broadcast that juice to the ground is too expensive. But nevertheless, Japanese are trying to do a solar wind farm, and one of the California energy companies is as well. Remember, the developing world wants this electricity. They want to look like we do in the developed world. Good, bright cities that are 24 hours a day, that's what a city is. So I think the green argument for coal is to compare what happens to the waste products between nuclear and coal. 40% of electricity in the world is used is made using coal, and here's what happens when you compare them. Basically, the spent fuel from one lifetime of nuclear electricity fits in a Coke can, pretty heavy Coke can. And meanwhile, a 1 gigawatt coal-fired plant every day uses 80 rail cars, each 100 tons of coal. And that turns into 19,000 tons of CO2 every day. Compare where the waste goes. 20 tons of nuclear fuel a year for 1 gigawatt of electricity from a nuclear plant, 2.9 million tons of coal for a 1 gigawatt coal-fired plant a year. And where that goes is in everybody's atmosphere. So when you compare the lifetime emissions per kilowatt hour from these energy sources, nuclear is right down there with hydro and wind, and it's still ahead of solar. I like solar. I have 4 different instances of it in my personal life and use it a lot. I like wind. We used to push that in the whole Earth catalog, but it's kind of changed scale since our day. This is not a rooftop wind generator. These things are huge and quite amazing infrastructure. Some people don't like them aesthetically. I kind of like them, but then I don't have to live near them. Basically, to get 1 gigawatt, I was just looking at 1 gigawatt coal, 1 gigawatt of nuclear, 1 gigawatt of wind farms would fill, to get that much electricity from wind farms takes about 250 square miles of wind farms. And these things have extensive power lines because typically the wind and the people are in different places. Go to solar. We're trying to put 1,000 square miles of solar in the deserts of Southern California. And it's coming down on beautiful country. You may say, well, they obviously wouldn't build it there, but if you look at this map, that's exactly where these things are going in. The Native Plant Society of California, which I'm part of, is starting to protest these things. What did I say? 50 square miles have to be bulldozed to get a gigawatt of electricity from solar. A fellow named Saul Griffith has done the math to add all these things up. For us to level off at the desired 450 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere in the next 25 years, you've got to have 13 trillion watts of new clean energy. So he broke it out. Okay, let's see, 2 terawatts of solar electric, that's 30,000 square miles of solar panels. 2 terawatts solar thermal, it's a little more efficient, 15,000 square miles of mirrors. And so on down the line, and then he still only got to 10 terawatts, and just to get to 13, he threw in 3 terawatts of nuclear, which would take, by the way, 3,900 1-gigawatt reactors. When you add all this up, he refers to it as Renewistan. That's an area about the size of the United States. A good book with these kind of numbers is David McKay's Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. He basically looks at the numbers, and it's an intensely sensible and very well-illustrated book that's worth tracking down. Another big issue is radiation. Chernobyl haunts us, but it's worth looking at the current reality there. Chernobyl is now Europe's richest wildlife preserve by far. The 300,000 people moved out. All the wild animals moved in. There's wolves there. There's all the endangered species of Europe. They've reintroduced some, like the European bison and Przewalski's horse, and they're thriving there as well. And as one biologist who studied the area for 10 years said, it's very interesting that the worst nuclear disaster in history is nowhere near as problematic for wildlife as what humans do all the time with farms and logging and cities and whatnot. So my expectation is that there will be a Chernobyl National Park, and we will all want to go there. There's lots to be said about weapons proliferation and nuclear. And I won't try to go into it because it's a big and interesting, complicated area, but one thing that most people don't realize is that in the States, 10% of our electricity is coming from recycled warheads from Russia. This megatons to megawatts program is basically buying up their bombs and missiles, downblending the weapons-grade uranium into fuel, and then burning it. So we have about 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear, half of that from these warheads, and we haven't finished with the Russian warheads yet, and we haven't even started on the U.S. warheads. But it's one of the nicest conversions of weapons to a of swords to plowshares that you'll see in the world. Huge question, for some reason, is what about nuclear waste? And I hear people saying, well, Yucca Mountain used to be the thing we focused on, and I think a very smart move. The Obama administration has said, forget that. There's lots of reasons Yucca's not so great. I've been there, it's pretty interesting. I know where it worked fine, but it's not as good as other places. Among the places it's not as good as is where the spent fuel is now. And the same here in Canada. It's standing around in dry cask storage out back of the parking lot at the reactor sites. And it's just fine. You can go stand there and be photographed next to it. Nothing's going to hurt you. Eventually, we may move this stuff into interim storage and then maybe put it in the ground. But it's fine right where it is while we spend 50 or 100 years deciding what we want to do with it. If we decide that recycling, the way the French do, is a good idea, it's there, ready to be used. Reprocessing still is pretty expensive and I think kind of gnarly, so that we could do something better on that. Well, there's some of the fourth generation of reactors that use this stuff directly as fuel. We may want to save it for that. So in Canada, you have the adaptive phased management approach on your nuclear waste, which is to not try to force that decision yet. If at some point you want to put it in the ground, you've got the world's stablest rock up in the Laurentian Shield. You can heave it down there and truly forget about it. In the U.S., we've been putting nuclear waste in the ground for 10 years in a place called the WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico. It works just fine. You're down in a salt formation half a mile down. And one of the great things about it is it's not going anywhere. It's a 250-million-year-old formation. It's going to stay there for that amount of time. There's nothing there but salt. And you put stuff in there, and it is truly isolated. A book I recommend on all of this is called Power to Save the World by Gwyneth Cravens. This sort of thing is why a lot of fairly prominent environmentalists have already either changed their mind or expanded their support for nuclear energy. Rather than go through the full, Al Gore and Bill McKibben look strange in that. They're what I call the reluctant tolerators. They will never say anything publicly. Nuclear is good, but sort of in testimony to Congress and so on, they say, well, you know, glad we have it. I guess it's going to grow somewhat. But more typical is Stephen Tyndale, who is head of Greenpeace UK, 2001-2008. And he kept track of how he changed his mind. He said it's like a religious conversion for environmentalists. What we find is that, as they say with climate, those who know the most are the most frightened. With nuclear energy, those who know the most are the least frightened. This is why I want environmentalists to bear down on the scientists. Here's a classic scientist, James Hansen at NASA, a leading climatologist, and the person behind the number 350, which is being celebrated all over the world today as a way to think about dealing with climate change, is to mitigate the carbon dioxide. James Hansen also said the following in an open letter to President Obama when he was just coming into office in January, that there's a danger of vehement anti-nuclear environmentalists heading off research into the next generation of nuclear reactors. He says that is a prescription for disaster. Basically, climate change is a problem of a size that governments have to step up to. That's part of why we care about what's going to happen in Copenhagen. If the European Union, Canada and the United States, China and India all do the right thing, we've got a pretty good shot. If one or more of them don't, then we may get into a situation where the countries flip into a self-preservation, you get a downward spiral of wars, that makes the climate worse, and so on. Fortunately, all over the world, in the developing world, and in Europe, there's a lot of countries that are moving ahead with nuclear. And one of the reasons this will move more quickly than people expected is there's a till recently unnoticed new generation of nuclear reactors that are basically micropower, micro reactors. They're This is what's happening with the Russian one, this first one being built, because they're, like the Northwest Passage here is opening up because of the melting of the ice there, Northern Sea Route is opening up, they're pouring concrete for ports, they need electricity there, and so they're doing it with these floating 35 megawatt reactors. A standard tiny 25 megawatt reactor is 1/64th of the big iron. That's basically one reactor, one small town. Just run through a few of these. Here's one of the first out of the box from Toshiba. Another one was designed by Lawrence Livermore Lab. Here's one that's commercial coming from New Mexico based on a design from Los Alamos. These microreactors are relatively cheap to build. Their design cycle is very fast. They're meltdown proof, they're proliferation proof. Typically you build them at a factory, truck them in or train them in, stick them in the ground, and turn on the electricity with a steam generator. And then you either haul it out and replace it 30 years later, or some of them you can just leave it in the ground. A company in Oregon called NuScale is building one, especially designed to build a module at a time. One of the oldest players, the makers of the reactors for the Navy, Babcock and Wilcox, has suddenly come out with a small reactor. And as I said, some of the designs are getting pretty radical. This one designed by Lowell Wood is being developed in Washington. It's a thorium reactor, which Indians will be very pleased with. There's three times as much thorium out there than there is uranium. And it has a lot of advantages. If it really works, this one is designed to, you put it in the ground, run electricity for 30 or 60 years, and then just leave it there. It's perfectly good to be where it is. I should say a thing or two about genetically engineered food crops. While I had to change my mind from over here to over here with nuclear as I looked at all this material, as a biologist, I'd always been kind of distressed at what my fellow environmentalists were getting all worked up about with genetically engineered food crops. They're seen as somehow unnatural, and to a biologist, they're perfectly natural. They do what microbes, these transgenic moving of genes from one species to another goes on all the time in biology, especially at the microbial level. And by and large, the genetically engineered crops, even though they weren't designed to be good for the ecology, are. And prominent environmental biologists like Ed Wilson and Peter Raven do not join any of these efforts against the genetically engineered foods. So who likes them? The Amish, who usually are really suspicious of any new technology. They are arguably the best farmers in America. They saw the quality of the seeds and stepped right up to it. Likewise, South Africa. We don't eat engineered sweet corn in North America. We just eat the engineered feed corn that goes into corn muffins and tortillas and so on. But one of the most popular foods in South Africa is white maize, which is engineered. A couple of books I recommend. One is The Doubly Green Revolution by Sir Gordon Conway. Another one is Tomorrow's Table by a organic farmer and his wife, a world-class genetic engineer, Pamela Ronald. And Mendel in the Kitchen by Nina Fedorov. She is a direct assistant to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It was kept from being an assistant to Condoleezza Rice because she's so good in the State Department. Genetically engineered food crops are the most rapidly successful agricultural innovation in history. Despite the efforts of my fellow environmentalists to prevent this from happening, they've taken off because farmers really like them. They also do good things for the environment because they enable no-till farming, especially, here's what happens. If you get this is the herbicide tolerant one, like the soybeans. About 95% of soybeans are GE now. Used to be you had to plow up every spring for to get the cover crops down and then take the first generation of weeds. The herbicide tolerant Roundup Ready or whatever plants, you can leave the soil where it is. You leave the what's left of last year's crop where it is. Just drill seeds through it with a little bit of fertilizer, and so the soil is getting richer from year to year. It's not washing away. It's not putting a lot of gases that you don't want in the atmosphere. They also reduce pesticide use and they increase yield, which means more land is freed up to be wild. This map from 2006 shows no GE activity in Africa. That's changed since then, but it was delayed for 10 years by my fellow environmentalists, especially Friends of the Earth International and Greenpeace International, basically frightening on purpose the African nations not to adopt this technology and not to even eat free food that was provided by the West that had some portion of it genetically engineered. This is, I think, where environmentalists have really known sin. We've done serious harm by being irrational. A good book on this is Starve for Science by Robert Perlberg. There's a moral issue here. The Newfield Council on Bioethics in England examined this exhaustively twice and decided that there is a moral imperative to make genetically engineered food crops available to the developing world. And as climate issues increase, this is how we're going to get food crops for the tropics that are drought tolerant, that are salt tolerant, that are flood tolerant. But it's not just, the developing world, cassava, Cassava Plus. This is a staple food for 800 million people. Basically, it's just starch. But it's now being, thanks to money from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, it's being engineered to have all of the things you would want in it. Likewise, sorghum, it's a drought-tolerant staple for 500 million. Bananas, I thought them as kind of decorative. Places like Uganda, they are the major food. This business of getting vitamin A in the food costs about a fifth of a cent for a person to get the amount that they need. Typically, vitamin A has been going to the developing world as vitamin A capsules, 500 million of them costing a dollar a piece. This is already a big saving. And you probably notice in here, a genetically engineered pig with omega-3 fatty acids is good as fish. We can back off on killing the fish, and we can eat as much bacon as we want. It just gets better and better for our heart. Likewise, people who are worried about allergies in peanuts, there's now a allergy-free peanut being engineered in the University of Georgia. So this stuff is coming directly to us. By the way, Greenpeace recently announced that they will do everything they can to prevent these biofortified engineered food crops from getting to the fields in Africa. The next generation of biotech is already underway. A fellow named Rob Carlson is the chronicler of this. He's got a wonderful book coming out shortly called Biology is Technology. And what he's noticing is the new domain called synthetic biology is moving very quickly. And from the young, a fellow named Drew Endy at Stanford is bending the minds of children with comic books that teach them how to engineer microbes, their genomes. And I've been saying for a while, I saw hackers back when transform computers from control machines into freedom machines. And I've been saying, where are the green biotech hackers? And it turns out they're showing up every year, doubling every year at this jamboree of the International Genetically Engineered Machine crowd at MIT. And some of the stuff is frivolous. I just added this yesterday. There's a blue rose now. It used to be the sort of classic thing. Well, you can get any kind of rose you want except blue. They got a gene from a petunia. No, sorry. Yeah, both petunia and a pansy. Stuck it in the rose, and Japan will now sell you a long-stem blue rose. This is from Suntory for $30. A lot of this stuff is going to be frivolous. Some of it's going to be crucial. That's the way it is with computers, and that's the way it is with biotech. Okay, a point of perspective here is a term that came into ecology in the early 90s is ecosystem engineer. It's a way to understand organisms that do what they call niche construction. Earthworms are famous for it. Charles Darwin studied and proved that good soil is made by earthworms just doing what they do. They make the soil good for themselves, and in the process, make the soil great for lots of other organisms. Another creature that does that is the beaver. Cuts down a few aspen, but it makes a pond that not only protects the beaver, but is then habitat for a vast variety of other creatures. The classic human example of an ecosystem engineer is Aldo Leopold. He inspired me and no end of other people to bear down on restoring natural systems, and he himself took a truly frapped out farm in Wisconsin and turned it into a forest on purpose. And that was 150 acres of damaged land that he was undoing the damage on. We have now planet scale systems that we need to undo the damage on. And that's why I get interested in direct intervention in climate. But that's going to get hairy, because here's the situation we're facing. We will come to take geoengineering more and more seriously, already are. Climatologists, you know, every time they poll them, more and more are saying, well, the politicians aren't going to fix it. I guess we're going to have some kind of geoengineering to head off these issues. Because mitigation doesn't move fast enough. The cost of putting in renewables is going to be huge. There are emergencies coming. Darfur is just one of many. And we keep finding out news, most of which is bad, as that we get better and better data from the field about what's going on with climate. Geoengineering is surprisingly cheap, actually. Not too long ago, it came in free. This was the explosion of a volcano called Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. And you had 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide, one of the commonest things in the world, going up 20 miles into the stratosphere, cooling off the entire planet by 0.5 degrees Celsius. The next year, you got extra ice in the Arctic, which made extra polar bears, who were referred to by the biologists as the Pinatubo cubs. So this is the system that climatologists especially like, kind of they know it works. The natural experiment, as they say, was a success. And people have looked at several different processes of getting basically a waste that we have, the stuff that we scrub out of coal-fired plants and so on, is sulfur dioxide. It can be sent up by hoses or by chimney to the stratosphere. The cost of doing that might be on the order of $30 billion a year. The climatologists say that if Pinatubo had kept on going, another one the next year, another one the next year, it would have cooled the planet by 3 degrees Celsius. That it would offset, in terms of temperature, a doubling of CO2. That's pretty interesting as a way to buy time. Another one that is relentlessly green is this idea that came from John Latham to have cloud brightening robot satellite guided ships that sail up and down with these cool Flettner sails. And then using the dynamic of moving through the water, atomized seawater, which goes up, dries quickly into a little salt crystal, which becomes the nucleus for a water particle, and if the theory works, brightens the albedo of the whole planet. Another idea, this one from Jim Lovelock and Chris Rapley, who runs the Science Museum in London, is to have 400-foot pipes going up and down that would get the cool, nutrient-filled water up to the surface where the sun is, and huge parts of the ocean have gone basically dead because they've stratified with heat. And this gets the nutrients through the thermocline up to the surface. And then what lives there fixes carbon, and carbon goes down to the bottom. Another idea seems a little dubious to me, but it might work. The artificial trees, a fellow named Klaus Lackner is working on techniques for what they call air capture. And if you capture the carbon dioxide next to greenhouses, you can sell that carbon dioxide because they use it in greenhouses. Food processing, water treatment, and so on. A scheme that everybody loves, we're still finding out if it's going to scale, is biochar, terra preta. It was developed by Amazon Indians at least 4,000 years ago to make the absolutely terrible soil of the rainforest to very good agricultural soil just by smoldering, pyrolyzing the agricultural waste and turning it into charcoal, which is incredibly stable. It goes in the soil, improves the soil vastly, and never leaves the soil. If that was done on a large enough scale, it would add up to serious carbon fixation over time. So all of these schemes give you a sense that we really are in what climatologist Paul Crutzen called the Anthropocene. This is the geological era which is dominated by human activity. You can see it in the geology, obviously. You can see it in the atmosphere. And it's going to be around what we've started to do as long as geologists are. So you could say, well, we talk about terraforming Mars, we are already terraforming Earth. The problem is that we're not doing it well, we're doing it badly. And I guess that leads to the major point I'm making with my book, which is that where in Whole Earth Catalog I said we are as gods and might as well get good at it, now I'm saying we are as gods and have to get good at it. Because what good at it means, I think, is a shift for the environmental frame of mind from ideology to pragmatism, from romantic identification with nature to scientific examination of nature, and then a moving on to engineering of nature, as we already are, only doing it with enough knowledge to do it well. That means doing it with as light a touch as possible, but as much intervention as necessary. Summing it up, I would say that ecological balance is too important for sentiment. It requires science. The health of natural infrastructure is too compromised for passivity. It requires engineering. And what we call natural and what we call human are inseparable. We live one life. Thank you. Can I have my last slide back, because it has information on these books which some people may want to have. Can I get my last slide back? Yes. Just leave that for a while in case anybody's.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stuart. As always, there's question time down the front here. Please come on down and remember to keep your question very short and to actually make it a question. No statements, please. Would you like to go ahead?
Thank you very much. I thought it was a very interesting discussion, but I wanted to ask you, isn't part of the problem, though, that Western culture has exported this philosophy across the world, and now they're trying to catch up? And my real concern is, when you feed 6 billion people, do you not ultimately end up with 12 billion? And some of these solutions, where do we ultimately end up without making the hard choice of saying, I'm sorry, we can't sustain this society and we can't continue to add to the population?
Thank you. Good question. And it's something is in the book, but I left out of the talk, which is that an astounding event that happens when people move to the city is their fertility. The birth rate goes down drastically right away from typically 6 out in the countryside to 2 or less in town. And so the thing which has already happened in the developed world of way below replacement birth rate is happening in the developing world with astounding speed. And it used to be, this is what's called the demographic transition. And it used to be assumed that when people got enough money, they stopped having so many kids. Now it turns out there's so much opportunity in town, hard as it is in the slums and so on, but that education you saw, and basically women are liberated by moving to town. That's what happens. And part of what they do with that liberation is have fewer, higher quality kids, which means they are doing whatever is necessary to get them really educated, as that gentleman from Dharavi shows. We are now in the process of what's called the population momentum. There's a lot of young people, fertile as turtles, but they're not having as many kids as before, so you'll see a final push toward somewhere between 8 and 9 billion by 2040, 2050. That'll be a peak, and then because the birth rates are so low, so rapidly, a rapid fall. So there's kind of this cusp that we're getting through, this bottleneck, as Edward O. Wilson calls it. And as we get through it, then the population pressure will go down. Now, if climate change moves ahead in that time frame, it brings carrying capacity down, then it's as if we had 12 billion people in the sense that there's too many for the carrying capacity. And then we've got to get really resourceful, and we'll be glad to have 6 or 8 really billion really smart people to deal with it. Good question, thank you.
Thanks for your presentation, Stuart. It was really great. I understand whole earth discipline, and I've just started reading your book in terms of vigilance and dedication, as you mentioned, but what do you think the future of the whole earth discipline looks like? Is it a role that we'll start to see more and more people occupying in terms of policy construction, individual scientific disciplines, where you'd have sort of a whole earth guru?
Say a little more. I'm not sure I get the question yet.
I could look at you as an example. I mean, you've come through an enormous number of social groups, professional groups, policy groups, and here you are as the advocate, as I see it, of whole earth discipline. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as a role that someone like you occupies, becoming more and more popular moving forward, or prevalent?
Quick, grab the message and run with it, because I have other fish I want to fry. But this is something I will stay with for a while. Previous books I've done, like you mentioned, How Buildings Learn, it was fun to do, but you know, converting architects is not the most fun in the world. In fact, it's basically impossible. But environmentalists have real things to care about and are at heart pragmatic, and the romanticism and so on makes us care deeply about this stuff. So I think there is a kind of a transition that I already see signs of, and it will move along at its own pace. I think part of what I'm trying to do is say, you know, time is actually short, and what I count on is a generational shift that I already see. For example, in nuclear, younger environmentalists who were not around for the Cold War and don't remember Chernobyl, but are very comfortable with fast-moving technology, are saying, hey, if this stuff works to head off the major emergency of my lifetime, which is climate change, what's the holdup? So I think part of what I'm pointing at is I think the number of dynamics are in motion here. Lots of different leaders going in lots of different ways, I think, is the way it'll happen. You already see with synthetic biology, I mentioned Drew Endy and George Church and Craig Venter and others are moving that technology and also speaking very well about it publicly and also being very, very responsible about it. Really engaging the public as to what's going on. That's an essential thing, I think.
That's what I was thinking about is that.
Yeah, engage the public. You know. Thank you.
Next question.
This past week, I saw Vandana Shiva speak at the University of Waterloo, and she's very opposed to genetic engineering of crops.
She's opposed to everything that's sensible. She's amazing. She is absolutely amazing, and the truth eludes her. But you know, lefties love her. I heard her talk once in Berkeley. She turns up twice in my book saying terrible things. Starvation is good for people if they, it is a proud thing to do if instead of eating genetically engineered food. And then she fought, you know, the coming of GE to India, which has been enormously effective for India, saying that it's some corporate thing that's coming. It didn't work out that way. So she's got a stance, but I think Vandana Shiva is not helpful, at least in these subjects. She also likes to say the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a terrible thing that is trying to corporatize her world. And that's actually pretty cruel because they are doing more than anybody I know to save that world.
Okay, yeah, because the facts that I heard her quote about India were just Monsanto's aggressive advertising of the genetically engineered seeds there has driven seed prices up astronomically. And despite them being resistant to pests pests have become accustomed to that and they've gotten around that and now they have to use a lot more pesticides than they did previously. So,
The science is otherwise on this. Monsanto is an interesting but distracting issue. I find Monsanto is worth busting, but for something different from what they're usually busted for. They're usually busted for doing genetically engineered food crops at all. Mm-hmm. Actually, I use Roundup, but it's very, all restorationists, they're really serious, use herbicides to get rid of the invasive plants. And it's pretty good. Actually, glyphosate is what Roundup is called. It's an amazingly low impact, very effective compound. why I think Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta and some of the others are unhelpful is they partly because we environmentalists made life so many regulations that a small company really can't survive. Oh. And so the big companies do. And it's to their benefit to have lots and lots and lots of controls that only a big company can fight their way through. And that's why in the States, we basically still have only two major kinds of genetically engineered food crops, the herbicide resistant and the insecticide containing ones like BT corn and BT cotton. Monsanto overprotects the intellectual property of the research tools of doing genetic engineering. And for at least a decade, it was very hard for the developing world to do their own biology, their own biotech. Thanks to Rockefeller Foundation, McKnight Foundation, Gates Foundation, workarounds have been made so that it's moving very quickly now in the developing world. And Monsanto sort of caught on that this is really bad publicity to be seen as starving people in the tropical agriculture, which they're not really part of so far. So I bust Monsanto for a completely different thing than most anti-GE activists do.
But I guess hopefully as there's more competition there, more companies come into this scene, then prices will go down, I guess.
Yeah. And I think synthetic biology may well loosen up all of this thing because there'll be so many interesting things going on. It'll be sort of like the in vitro fertilization issue, which used to be huge 15, 20 years ago. I talked about it a little bit yesterday at the panel we had. And now everybody's going, well, you know, I know these various people your age and older who were test tube babies, which we used to know was an abomination, and now we know that they're actually really great children. So I think that kind of shift is going to go on in this area. It's just taken longer than it should have. Next question. Thanks.
You mentioned twice that we don't have good models and theories for Earth growth and climate change.
I'm not sure I entirely understood the question, did you?
You mentioned that we don't have good models and theories for climate change and Earth growth. My question is, it is so hard to develop them, or we don't want bad enough to work on it?
Why do we not have such good models of climate change?
Thank you. Why do we not have such good models of climate change? I'm not sure we have the math yet. Climate change is so profoundly complex. It is so profoundly nonlinear, with so many interconnected positive feedbacks and negative feedbacks and these various tipping points, some of which you can see and some of which you can't, that the models are getting better because the data is getting better and the models are getting smarter. But the best models we had, like the IPCC models, said that the Arctic ice was going to be seriously melting by 2040, 2050. And instead, the summer of 2007, as Canadians know better than most, it melted way ahead of schedule. Didn't fit the models. So there was a positive feedback going on there because the more the ice melts, ice is very reflective, water is very absorbent. That makes the water warmer, that makes less ice, and so it goes. The rainforests, it is presumed, have a similar quality. As they dry up, they make themselves drier because they stop making the clouds and the rain that keeps the rainforest a rainforest. But where's the threshold? Where's the tipping point? We don't know. I think your demand for way better climate models is the right one to make. But for those models to be worth anything, we need way better data and better theory, especially what goes on in the oceans. James Lovelock says that we're running basically on intellectual vapor in our understanding of what goes on, especially with the microbial world, which is 90% of ocean life, what it's doing. It makes the atmosphere. One of the books I quote in my book is The New Science of Metagenomics, the opening line of which is, microbes rule the world. It's that simple. which is pretty neat because it's a whole, you know, opening up field of ecology, which was closed to us before, and with the new techniques, like shotgun sequencing, metagenomics, we'll begin to understand it, and that will improve climate science.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe I could just bring, before the next question from the audience here, bring a question from our online audience to you. So Phil asks, I can read it.
I know, so can I.
Many of the considerations being made are based on our planet being the limit to both space and resources. Would you say that maybe this is narrow-minded, that we should be thinking more broadly, in the same way as people like Carl Sagan? Sorry.
Getting off planet, is that what he's suggesting?
I believe that's probably what he's suggesting, yes.
I'm embarrassed to say, no, I'm proud to say, I was a proponent of space colonies back in the 1970s. Worked with Gerard and Neil and other people who sort of put out this idea that extra humanity could go and start over in orbiting hollow planets, basically rotating cylinders. And they could be in interesting places like the Lagrange points that are gravitationally stable. But then you start doing the math, and yeah, we can probably do it, and yeah, it would be very interesting for the people living there. It would probably be a little bit like the space station to the that we have now, only bumped up a bit. People are not that eager to stay in the space station very long. Charles Simonyi went up and then he came right back down. But then he went up again and he's coming down again. So it's not all that attractive yet. And the numbers are, if we're talking about 8 billion people, you know, to get a significant number of those off planet, I guess will happen, but not in the next 50 years, maybe the next 100, maybe ever.
Next question, please.
Given your answer to the previous question about the lack of understanding of the coupling, tipping points, and thresholds, geoengineering and GMO seem to be major interventions where we don't necessarily have all the knowledge about what the interventions will do. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, if we don't understand climate, how are we going to do geoengineering without screwing it up royally? The way you intervene in a very complex system like that is very carefully, small and as reversibly as possible. So I mentioned the sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere approach. Sulfur dust in the stratosphere can be done at way smaller level than Mount Pinatubo did. We could do it in the lower stratosphere, maybe in the Arctic, and see if it works. Smaller quantity, lower altitude, in a relatively self-contained weather system like the Arctic, where there's not a lot of people, there is a lot of polar bears, and you've got the amplifier of the ice. So if it does work, then you already get a multiplier effect because the more ice that year, more polar bears. And you can say, okay, that was pretty good. Let's do a little more, a little higher. And you know, keep doing it until you're starting to get problems that you don't like, and then back off half a turn, or stop entirely. That's what you want with any of these systems, is not to have a bet the planet approach. In the course of this, I mean, this is how you learn about systems, is you intervene a little bit, you perturb it, and you see what happens. So. Al Gore hates geoengineering. He says, running experiments on the whole planet is a bad idea. Forget it. And I say, yeah, absolutely, except, you know, what if all this other stuff doesn't work? How do you buy time for the other stuff to come on? And that's a disagreement we have. I think he'll come around. But he will come around by this kind of doing the research, do some incremental stuff, learn from it, and that's what you do with any intervening in a large system. That's what we did with agriculture. Learned very gradually, stage to stage to stage, until now 40% of the ice-free land area of the world is in agriculture. That did not happen all at once. What else?
I have another online question.
Okay.
Tatiana from Toronto would like to know, how do you think advancements in quantum technologies could revolutionize the whole Earth discipline? Can you envisage any radically new solutions coming from theoretical physics? We are, after all, here at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
Well, Well, I noticed the slideshow that we saw, which is beautiful at the beginning, didn't have many quantum pictures that were mostly cosmos.
Oh, the quantum were at the very beginning.
There were a couple in there that I missed.
Beginning. Okay. Yep.
It's sort of hard to get good images at things that are below the resolution of light waves. The answer to what do I think, how quantum will intersect with whole earth discipline, the answer is I have no idea. Whatever. I hope great things will emerge, you know, quantum computers that can figure out how the climate actually works and model it perfectly. That would be swell.
Another question?
I'm a high school teacher, and a lot of my students will listen to these sorts of presentations and say, this is great, but what can I do? Mm-hmm. And do you have any suggestions for what I can tell either my students about what steps they should be taking in the future apart from attending these lectures and listening more?
Main thing is science. In the U.S., 1956, when Sputnik went up, scaring the bejesus out of all America, for good reason. Suddenly, science and math was the thing that everybody had to learn. And the whole generation of scientists came out of that, basically, response to what was seen as an emergency. Well, I think climate is our new Sputnik. And so, people who want to rise to the occasion, I would love to see the political process filled with the scientists and engineers who've run for office, not just been appointed. We've got a better administration in the States now. We're appointing people like Stephen Chu, head of the Energy Department, and people like John Holdren, who likes nuclear, to be a science advisor. But we still got a lawyer in charge, good as he is. One of the things that everybody's watching in the developing world is what Singapore does, which is run by basically engineers, and what China does, which is run basically by engineers. So I guess I'm suggesting do science and math, and especially ones that seem to bear relation to these issues, and also be politically engaged. Because there has been a kind of ivory tower thing of once you become a scientist, you don't even notice what's going on politically except in terms of where your money's coming from. Well, we need to get more into the policy business. Thanks. Good question.
I have one very quick question for you.
Yes.
Just wondering if you can say a little, it's not that quick, but we only have a couple minutes, so your answer will have to be fairly quick. If you could say a little about the fourth generation nuclear power. I've heard something about this. It seems interesting, but I don't know much about it.
Fourth generation nuclear power. We're now, the ones that are being built now by Westinghouse and Areva and so on are what's referred to as generation 3+. They're like the ones the CANDU and so on that are out there, are basically so-called generation 2. The next ones are safer, more efficient, cheaper, they're relatively meltdown-proof, and just better. The technology has been out there for 40 years, it's getting better and better. Generation 4 is where you really move into a new domain. I focused on part of it here, which I think is particularly appealing to the environmental frame of mind, which is micropower, meaning micro-reactors. And there's even more designs and entities pushing those out there. The pebble bed reactor, which was invented in Germany, and then Germany went severely green. And so the designs went to South Africa, which has been pushing them ahead. But meanwhile, China, working with South Africa, is moving toward having working pebble bed reactors, which are totally meltdown-proof, and like all these other, basically live underground. But the amazing stuff will be things like the integral fast reactor, thorium reactor that I showed a little taste of. There's another one called the traveling wave reactor. And these are ones that are drastically more efficient, drastically cheaper, and do things like take the nuclear waste that we have standing around in the dry cask storage and turn it directly into fuel. Most of the fourth generation are much higher temperature, and that means that if you like hydrogen as a way to park energy and move it into vehicles or whatever, they're hot enough to generate hydrogen. Even better from my standpoint is they're hot enough to do serious desalination. In California, we've basically dried up the Colorado. But places like Los Angeles, which are already putting in some desalination, if you have it, one of these fast reactor plants, it is not only giving you very reliable, cheap electricity, but it can also be providing relatively inexpensive clean water from the ocean. Most of the world has moved to the coasts, and so they're near. People are near where the seawater is, so that aspect of fourth generation looks pretty good. Tonight, there's a Science in the Pub meeting about fusion, so I've been doing my homework on that. And I was astounded to find that there's actually a version of fusion, which is a microreactor, 30 to 40 megawatt, what they call a compact tokamak reactor, one of many schemes that are out there. They're way further along, frankly, than I thought. So I had thought, going into this book, that nuclear is pretty much plateaued. It's good, it works. It's a little problematic, but that's sort of it, and we can live with this for a few decades and then come up with something better, maybe. Well, it may well be that something better is already on the way. That's generation four.
Well, thank you. That's unfortunately all we have time for at present. Just before we go, some quick reminders. Our next event is at 6 p.m. EDT. It's called Worlds Beyond Earth. It'll be a panel discussion. Thank you very much to everybody joining us here in Waterloo, to those of you online. Also, you may be interested to know that the Chapters Bookstore has many signed copies of Stuart's new book, if you would like to check it out, the back of the atrium. And yes, please join me in thanking Stuart one last time.